Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Today is day two of Russia's multi-pronged invasion of its neighbor, Ukraine. The capital, Kyiv, is surrounded as Russian troops begin to fight their way into that city. Intelligence suggests Russia could take the capital city in the next 1 to 4 days. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky has called on civilians to prepare Molotov cocktails. Zelensky himself announced yesterday that he is, quote, target number one, and his family, quote, target number two, but vowed to stay in place. Zelensky called for talks, and Russian President Vladimir Putin says he's open to negotiations, but only if Ukraine agrees, essentially, to surrender. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, the largest war on European soil since World War II has begun. Why it happened, and what comes next. In a moment, we're going to hear from Kyiv, but first, joining me from Washington is Derek Chollet, counselor of the U.S. Department of State. Derek, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you, Kimberly. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, what is the U.S. position now? We are seeing Russia advance into Ukraine, headed toward its capital. What is the position of the United States?
Well, Kimberly, this is an instance where we, of course, hoped we had been wrong. For several months, we have been watching this threat against Ukraine unfold. And what we've seen transpire in the last 72 hours is unfortunately what we were expecting. This is a completely unjustified, unwarranted, premeditated attack upon a sovereign country by Russia. And as we're seeing the images unfold minute by minute from Ukraine, the situation is only getting worse. The United States has taken some tough measures in response. We promised a swift and severe response if Russia chose this path of escalation and confrontation. And you've seen President Biden, alongside our partners in Europe and elsewhere, unfurl a series of swift and severe sanctions that will be devastating to the Russian economy. And we hope will change the calculus of Vladimir Putin as he pursues this very dangerous course he has put the world on.
So you're talking about the swift and severe sanctions that are coming from the U.S. and other Western countries. President Biden says he expects that to take time. This isn't just going to make Russia essentially stop. Explain how that works. How are these sanctions, if they're not deterrent, what's the purpose of them?
Well, as we were trying to pursue the diplomatic solution here with Russia over the past several months, we made very clear that if they chose a path of escalation and confrontation, the consequences would be swift and severe. The sanctions that the United States and our European partners and others have announced in the last several days are truly unprecedented in scope and scale. It's far beyond anything we've done against Russia before, certainly far surpasses what was done in 2014. Just yesterday, now the 10 largest banks in Russia have been sanctioned. That's holding about 80% of Russia's banking assets and billions and billions of dollars. There's export controls against Russia, which will hinder its ability to import nearly half of the material it needs to operate effectively on the world stage and make it very difficult for their aerospace industry, for the defense industry, as well as for their maritime industry to further develop and innovate. Just yesterday, we saw the stock market in Russia drop precipitously, far beyond what it suffered in the 2008 financial crisis or even the 1998 global financial crisis. The ruble has dropped to historic lows. And it's very important to note, this is a sanctions coalition. This is not just the United States moving out alone. This is the United States, our European partners, other countries like Australia, the United Kingdom, Japan, representing well over half of the world's GDP. And so these sanctions will have a lasting impact on Russia. And I believe that this crisis, as terrible as it is and how much suffering that it will cause in Ukraine and elsewhere, will be a major strategic setback for Russia in the long run.
Now, before I get to questions about the military side of this, on these sanctions, some of them are expected to have other effects, including rising gas prices, something that Americans may feel. Can you talk a little bit about that? What impact can you expect this to happen economically?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you've heard, President Biden has been very clear on this, that there will be some pain associated with these sanctions and pain that all of us will feel. Obviously, most of the pain is going to be felt in Russia, but clearly our European partners, which have a much more comprehensive trading relationship with Russia, will be feeling a lot of pain, as will some Americans. And the Biden administration has been working very hard and will continue to work very hard and use every measure at our disposal to ensure that things like energy prices do not go up too much and to ease any of the pain that might be felt by Americans. But I think it's very important for all of us to remember the large stakes here. This obviously is a major security crisis for Ukraine, and there'll be tremendous suffering inside Ukraine over the next several weeks and months. But it's also the greatest security crisis we have faced in Europe since the Second World War. And the principles at stake here, the idea that countries cannot change borders by force, the idea that states have a right to their own sovereignty, what Russia is doing really is a dagger pointed at the heart of the international system itself and the rules-based order that we've all been able to prosper under for many, many decades. And so the consequences of this crisis could be quite profound.
And let's be clear here. The consequences of this crisis, could this lead to a broader war? Is this an effort of Putin essentially to reestablish the former Soviet Union? And could efforts to stop that by the United States and its allies lead to a bigger war?
Well, we've heard from President Putin directly several times over the last several days of how he's framed this crisis and what his larger goals are. And clearly, this is far beyond the question of NATO or really anything the United States has done. This is about, in some ways, trying to reconstitute the Soviet Union and unravel the last quarter century of efforts to make Europe more secure. War always takes unpredictable paths, and that's why that President Biden has been very clear that our Article 5 commitment to our NATO allies, and that's the commitment of mutual self-defense, remains strong, that the United States will defend every inch of NATO territory. Today, President Biden is meeting virtually in a special NATO summit with the other 29 leaders of NATO to talk about this crisis, talk about what NATO is going to do collectively to better protect our alliance. And so we've seen no indications that President Putin is seeking to widen this conflict. But nevertheless, we remain steadfast and very clear that we will defend every inch of NATO territory.
So the U.S. has stated that sending troops out is out of the question. So what other means besides these sanctions, which will take some time, does the U.S. have to try to curb this invasion?
Well, again, the sanctions will be profound. They will have a lasting impact, and we will continue to unfurl additional sanctions and efforts to further isolate and punish Russia and hopefully change its calculus in the coming days. Secondly, we will continue to provide our support for the Ukrainian people. We have been in regular touch with Ukrainian leadership. Secretary of State Blinken spoke once again today with the Ukrainian foreign minister. President Biden has been in regular touch with President Zelensky, who's in Kyiv. And we will continue to support the Ukrainians to deal with, first, this humanitarian disaster that's going to be occurring in their country, but then also to provide them the ability to protect themselves, as we have been doing for the last 8 years. And then finally, we will work with our allies and partners to further isolate Russia in the international community. And you're seeing many steps along those lines from private sector actors to governments further isolate Russia. Again, I think that in the long run, this will be a major strategic blow to Russia. President Putin seems to think somehow this will work in Russia's advantage, but I think by almost every measure, in terms of its economy, in terms of its role in the world, its place in the world, this will be a setback for Russia in the long run.
Derek, let me ask you, why should this conflict and why should Ukraine matter to Americans? We know that Americans are war weary after the U.S. involvement in several conflicts that have come that have been drawing down. The U.S. is not directly sending troops there. We're seeing these images. But why is it important for Americans to pay attention to this war?
Well, Kimberly, this is the greatest security crisis that Europe has faced since the Second World War. And it could take an unpredictable direction. It's in our interest to try to ensure that it doesn't and that we remain by our commitments to our European partners through our obligations at NATO. This crisis will have a tremendous impact on the global economy, no question about it. It's going to create it's very destabilizing inside Europe, and it's going to affect the global economy and therefore ensuring that we're doing whatever we can to stop that from happening. And mitigating the damage as best we can, it's very important. And then finally, the fundamental principles at stake here, really the most fundamental principle in the international system and upholding the order, which is that borders can't be changed by force, that countries can choose their own destiny. Those are at stake here. And the larger message that is going to be sent if we do not act would be profound and put us all in peril in the future. That's why I heartened up to this point. We have seen such tremendous support in the international community and a very clear message by many, many countries, most leading countries, against what has happened. And I think that as this conflict rages on, and unfortunately I think that it will for quite some time, we will continue to see that momentum against what Russia is doing only build. And so it's very, very important for the United States to remain the leading player in this, but we are doing it alongside our allies and partners.
And Derek, just in the few seconds we have left, talk about the humanitarian aspect of this. We're already seeing refugees fleeing the country.
Yeah, this has the potential to be a true humanitarian disaster. We are quite concerned about the number of displaced persons inside Ukraine, but then also those fleeing Ukraine, crossing borders and becoming refugees. For the last several months, we have been working particularly with those countries who border Ukraine to help them better prepare for the potential refugee crisis. And we're also working on ways that we could provide assistance inside Ukraine to those who are displaced by this crisis.
All right. Derek Chollet is counselor of the U.S. Department of State. Thank you very much for your time, Derek.
Thanks so much for having me, Kimberly. I really appreciate it.
We're following developments in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. When we come back, we'll ask why exactly this is happening. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. We're discussing Russia's decision to invade its neighbor, Ukraine, in the largest war on European soil since World War II, and why this is happening. Joining us from Kyiv is reporter Terrell Germain-Starr. Terrell, welcome to you.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
And thank you very much for joining me. I know you are on the ground in Kyiv seeing what has developed over the past couple of days. Describe to us the scene right now.
Yeah, so right now, one of the key things that you will see is around the city, you will see common citizens with automatic rifles right now. And so the government is giving up, you know, giving thousands of automatic rifles to citizens who are willing to fight for the country. I went to three recruiting centers and they're teeming over with volunteers. There is no shortage of men who, you know, people who are willing to fight for Ukraine and sacrifice their lives for this country. You also see long queues at gas stations of people trying to find the nearest way out. That's very key content. And then also you'll find ATMs that are that are teaming over, long queues at the ATM line. You'll see lines at grocery stores. In fact, when I get off this interview, I'm going to go to the grocery store myself to stock up. So everybody is preparing for guerrilla warfare pretty much in the capital. There are checkpoints being established across the city at this point. And then there are also some damage to buildings. On my Twitter, people will see video that I captured of a building that was hit, from what I understand to be debris from a missile that potentially was intercepted last night. So this is a city under siege here for sure.
And Terrell, you spent a lot of time in Kyiv over the years. I should tell our listeners you're also a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and you've been covering foreign policy for a long time. How different does this feel? We've heard Ukrainians say that they've been living under the prospect of invasion by Vladimir Putin for a long, long time. But does this look like you expected it to?
Yes, it did. And I just want to give a shout out to MSNBC counterterrorism analyst Malcolm Nance, who's been showing me the ropes about how these things work during his visit here for the over 2 weeks. Really, he's been here more than 2 weeks, but I was something of a tour guide for him, took him around the country. He himself went to the front to see things. And so, people have been used to this, but what is new is that these attacks are happening across the country. This country has not experienced widespread shelling. In fact, the building that I told you about where I captured video, it's about a 15-minute walk from where I live. And so that could have easily have hit me and taken people out in this building. So it's a lot more widespread. It's a lot more brutal. And the language that Putin uses to describe why he's doing this, quote unquote, because there's no legitimate reason why he's doing this, it's very degrading of Ukrainian people. It's very racist. It's very fascist. And so just the language that he uses, you know, he describes them, Ukrainians, as subhuman beings. I would make it akin to how racist folks in America would talk about black people. It is very much similar in that way. Also, he talks about Crimean Tatars in his first speech where he recognized the Donbass, Luhansk regions in the east. He referred to Crimean Tatars, an ethnic group in Crimea, which was illegally annexed, as Islamic terrorists. So if an American official were to use that language towards any group of people, they would be shamed, they would be admonished, they would be called out for being Islamophobic, they would be called out for being racist. But so I think we need to be really we need to have some context to really describe the cultural dynamics of why Putin is doing this, because it has nothing to do with geopolitics or NATO.
Terrell, earlier today on CNN, we saw you interviewing your friend Andre as you drove around Kyiv. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
Yes, it is a dangerous situation, but, you know, we can do so much to influence where we are and influence what's happening with us. So now it's beyond our control. So I just need to concentrate on things that I can realistically do to help our military to stop this invasion.
What have you said to your wife in case, and I hate to say this because you're a friend of mine, but if you do not, if you end up losing your life, say this, and again, it hurts me to ask, but have you spoken to your family about the possibility that you will lose your life?
We have not spoken about that, but we all definitely realize what can happen. And I'm in touch with my family right now. And so They know. We all know. We need to get this done. We need to get this done. That's it. And nobody else will do it besides us. We get no help.
Terrell, talk a little bit about this, the fact that ordinary citizens are being called to take up arms and fight to protect Ukraine. Do they have what they need? And you know, you're talking about the real personal nature of this, the psychological aspect. Talk more about that.
Yes. So the thing about Ukraine is that, first of all, you don't see this in mainstream media, but the army here, you know, the Ukraine does have a military and has been fighting valiantly, and they're doing a better job fighting the Russians than most people expected them to, especially because they're outnumbered, and Russia is the second most powerful military on earth. So in regards to regular citizens, there's a resilience here amongst the Ukrainian people that is really really inspiring, even for me. You walk around the streets, there's an attitude of, I'm going to go about my life as best I can. For example, the psychological impact, I'm looking outside of my window right now, and every once in a while, you will hear explosions in the background, and then you will also see fighter jets buzzing by. You know, that's a common thing that people are slowly beginning to get used to right now because the airspace is closed. I'm looking out, and I'm also seeing people with luggage, with rolled baggage, getting ready to leave the city. However, they can. Right now, folks are basically hugging each other, saying their goodbyes, wishing themselves well for those who will stay, and then for those who are going to go on the road, because there's no place here where you could be particularly safe. And so you can go to a shelter, but the shelters are being bombed. You can try to make it outside of the city, but a cruise missile necessarily doesn't discriminate. And so you can be hit on the road on your way out. And so there's no place that's safe here, but it's taking a psychological toll on people. My friends, my colleagues who are journalists like myself say that this experience has changed them. On a political front, it has made them despise and hate Russia more than ever. And I thought that it was intense prior to this happening, but there is no way that these people are going to give up this city. I think every single person will die before, in their words, become slaves to Russia.
Terrell, hold just for one moment. I'd like to bring in Angela Stent to the conversation. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor emerita at Georgetown University. Angela, welcome.
Thank you, Kimberly.
So I want to pick up with you on the point that Terrell was just making, that the effect of this among the Ukrainians in Kyiv and beyond is to make them hate Russia even more, even if Russia is able to take Kyiv, take over the government, install its own leaders there. That's not the end of this, right? If they cannot win over the Ukrainian people. Talk about how this works.
Yes, they certainly can't win over the hearts and minds of the Ukrainian people. And I think, I mean, as I said, what I believe will happen is that they will subdue Kyiv, that they will put in a puppet government. But then they don't want to occupy Ukraine. They don't have the forces to do that, nor do they want to expend the resources. And I don't think that puppet government is going to have an easy time. I think, as Terrell said, what Russia has done has turned the Ukrainian population against Russia. He's united them, with a much stronger sense of national identity. And there will be resistance, all kinds of different resistance, including armed resistance, probably some kind of an insurgency, but also, you know, passive resistance. So it's not going to be easy to subdue Ukraine. I think that Putin and the people around him really don't understand Ukraine very well. And they have this idea, and I've heard one of these Russian, you know, pundits say that, well, you know, everything's malleable. The Ukrainians will get used to this and they'll change their national consciousness. That's not how it works.
And so why is Russia, we heard Terrell talk about some of the reasons why Putin is doing this that goes far beyond NATO, but why is Russia doing this invasion? They use the justification that it's the West that actually has encroached on Ukraine, and they are trying to rid it of that influence. But explain to us why a democratic Ukraine is such a threat to Vladimir Putin.
Well, Vladimir Putin, and he made this clear 15 years ago in a speech that he made at the Munich Security Conference, he believes that Russia is a great power and it has a right to a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space and maybe beyond. And he believes that the United States and its allies have prevented Russia from doing this. So he has been building up to this invasion for a long time. He apparently believes that Ukrainians and Russians are one people, but he believes that an independent Ukraine is a threat to Russia because it's trying to move west. It's a much more democratic country. It has free elections. It would like to join NATO and the European Union, although those things aren't on offer. And yes, a democratic Ukraine would be a threat to Russia, because if the Ukrainians can do it, why can't the Russians? So it's a number of reasons, but it's also trying to restore the sphere of influence to control the government of Ukraine and of the other post-Soviet states.
Terrell, I want to ask both you and Angela this. Terrell, I want to start with you. Has the state of mind of Vladimir Putin seemed to change? I mean, Angela's right. This has been a long time coming that Putin has wanted to do it. But this sort of overt, complete invasion of a country isn't something that we in the West would have expected a few years ago. Is there something about Putin and his strategy that, to you, Terrell, seems to be changing?
First of all, thank you, Angela. Pleasure to be a co-panelist with you on this discussion. And also, I'm not. I don't think that there's anything particularly that has changed in Putin's thinking. So, for example, in 2008, he did invade Georgia. I was in Georgia as a graduate student that summer when the Russian tanks rolled through. So this is not my first time at Putin's rodeo. And he has shown this very imperial colonial mindset where he will use the military to break people that he does not feel that will become his serfs. He has the mindset of a czar. He wants to be an incarnation of Peter the Great or Catherine the Great, more specifically, right? You know, because his whole attitude is they took land, no bloodshed. I mean, this is the way that he thinks, and this is the way that he often talks on Russian television. And so what we see right now in Ukraine is a long time coming based on what he has said about Ukraine before. I have to keep emphasizing this. The reason why he is doing this is to subjugate the Ukrainian people. Stalin, back in the early 1930s, committed the Holodomor against the Ukrainian people, essentially starving them to death. If Ukrainians have had a long history of resisting and pushing back against Russian imperialism, and when that doesn't work, then the only option that the Kremlin has is to kill them. So no, this psychotic thinking that comes out of the Kremlin towards Ukraine has been a mindset of every leader that has taken the helm of the Kremlin for centuries.
Angela?
First of all, I do want to say, Terrell, I'm an avid follower of yours on social media, and I thank you for all the reporting that you're doing from there and also your support for the Ukrainians. So I would agree that, you know, that sort of having the subjugation of Ukraine has a long history, and under Stalin there was this artificial famine where they tried to starve out the Ukrainians, and that Putin has been wanting to do this. But I do think that, and people who have met with Putin recently, particularly, you know, President Macron, France, and others, have said that he's changed, that he has, I think, the 2 years of COVID isolation, the fact that he's just listening to a few people, all of whom are feeding into his mindset, has probably affected him too. I'm not saying that this wouldn't have happened 3 or 4 years ago, but I think the brutality that we see, and I think he really, you know, he doesn't understand, the people in the Kremlin don't really understand Ukraine very well, and he's apparently taken this action just by, you know, consulting with a few people. So I think maybe something has changed, and I think that should worry us too.
And Angela, is this something that we should have seen coming during the annexation of Crimea? Certainly Crimea is a point that was crucial in this current invasion. Was this something that the West should have better expected or better prepared for?
Yeah, I think we were caught unawares in February of 2014 and March of 2014, just as we were caught unawares in the Russian-Georgian war. And I think everybody kept thinking, well, all right, Putin has Crimea, and there's this sort of war going on in the Donbas between Russia and Ukraine, but it's going to be contained. I think at least since last July, when Putin published this 5,000-word essay with a very unique view of Russian-Ukrainian history, saying that Russians and Ukrainians are one people, and Ukraine was never an independent country. And then the former president Medvedev published an article calling Ukrainians vassals of the United States. I think we maybe should have been more aware of what might happen. I just think it was inconceivable to most civilized people that, 77 years after the end of World War II, you'd have another major conflict in Europe. We thought that sort of that had all gone away. And unfortunately, we were wrong.
And Angela, just one last question before you leave us. Do you think that this could lead to a broader war? People are worried about World War III.
I think we have to be very careful. In one of the two ultimatums that the Russians delivered to the West in December, they demanded that NATO withdraw its military posture to where it was in 1997, before NATO enlarged. And at the same time, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said that when the Warsaw Pact broke up, Central and Eastern Europe were orphaned because they lost Mother Russia. So there is a sort of menace here that Russia is also looking not only in restoring its sphere of influence in its neighborhood, but in the former Warsaw Pact countries. I'm not sure how they think they're going to do that. What worries me now is that this war between Russia and Ukraine could have unexpected and unintended consequences. Let's say there's a cyber attack that affects Poland, a major one, mm-hmm. or there's some incident where this hostilities could spread to neighbors like Romania, Poland, the Baltic states, who are NATO members. What does NATO then do?
All right. Angela Stent, senior fellow at Brookings and author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Yes.
Terrell, hold tight. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking this hour about the developing situation in Ukraine, what Russia will do next, what happens to the people of Ukraine, and what NATO and allies are planning to respond to Putin's war. We're joined by Terrell Jermaine Starr, a journalist and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. And let me bring into the conversation Mariana Bujarin. She is a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center and author of the forthcoming Inheriting the Bomb, The Collapse of the USSR and the Nuclear Disarmament of Ukraine. Mariana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. So I want to turn now to the perspective of the Ukrainian people and Ukrainian officials. Why are they willing to wage this fight, potentially lose a lot of soldiers in this battle against what a much better armed Russia? What is the perspective of the Ukrainian people here?
Well, Kimberly, I don't think Putin left Ukrainians much choice in this matter. From the standpoint of Ukrainian people and Ukrainian leadership, this is the battle for Ukraine's existence as a state, because if Kremlin would have it, Ukraine would cease to exist in the form that it exists right now, as an independent sovereign state that is free to choose its own destiny.
And you have family that is in Ukraine. You have been in touch with them. Tell us about their current situation.
Yes, my mother lives in Western Ukraine in the city of Lviv, which is close to the Polish border. Although this is no big relief at this point, since we see that the Russian armed forces use air power and ballistic and cruise missile power to hit Ukrainian targets. I was just in Ukraine last week, actually, on a personal matter to support my mom. And the atmosphere there, and I'm sure Terrell will second that, was really that of defiance, right? We saw the troops all amassed at the border. We heard there was a feeling of this impending war, that it's coming. But people were going about their business. They were saying, when it comes, we'll just take up arms and defend our country, because this is a land and we are going to stay strong and do what we can at this point. But I think there was still last week this hope, this note of optimism that surely Mr. Putin is not insane to do something as atrocious. Surely he might want to destabilize Ukraine by perhaps, recognizing the Luhansk and Donetsk People's Republics, maybe militarizing them more, but surely he would not launch this full-scale invasion. And most of the people were wrong, as were we in the West as well. And I spoke with my mom this morning, and I think there's a lot more anxiety and a lot more, fear in her voice today than there was even yesterday.
And are there members of your family who, like the people we've been hearing from, like Terrell's friend Andre, who are taking up arms?
I have two cousins who are 36 years old, so they are, they have to go registered for and get registered for general mobilization. They have not been called up yet, but they are, standing by and ready to be called up.
Well, we are thinking about you and your family. Terrell, I want to bring you in on this point that Mariana was making about the defiance of the Ukrainian people. Even if they didn't fully believe that this was coming, now they are acting defiantly.
Yes, first of all, Mariana, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to co-panel this discussion with you. Yes, in regards to the defiance of the Ukrainian people, we talked about earlier today, we talked about change in Putin. I want to talk to you about the change in the Ukrainian people that I witnessed over the past 10 years. There was already a cultural change politically after the first revolution in 2004 here in Ukraine, after the Rose Revolution that took place across the Black Sea in Georgia just a month earlier that year. And so the Ukrainians already started culturally realizing that what Putin was selling was not something worthy of them putting the rest of their lives into. It was not good stock. And they determined that Putin is just a bad salesman because he's an abuser. And so you saw that shift in 2004, but even more so, you saw a cultural shift in 2014 after they saw that Putin was willing to literally kill them in order to make them serfs, in order to for Ukrainian people to fit within his czarist vision of an empire. And so already you have people, for example, who initially were not pro-NATO. Now, there's a vast majority of the Ukrainian people who want to be pro-NATO. And many people didn't know about their alliance before then, but they definitely want to do so now. Just coming into Ukraine after that, you know, it just feels like a very different place. Just even walking down the neighborhoods, and this place will never be the same that it was prior to Putin invading it.
Mariana, we heard Andrei, Terrell's friend, earlier say that what Ukrainians need are moral support and arms, that that's what they need from the West. They don't need actual NATO or U.S. military support, but they need arms and moral support. Talk a little bit about what the U.S. and the West does in the long term. How will they respond? Is Andrei right? Is that the best thing that they can provide Ukraine right now?
Well, I can't speak on behalf of Andrei, but it seemed that what he might have meant was that Ukrainians have learned not to expect military or direct military involvement from NATO in the West. This has been made very clear by President Biden and other Western capitals that is out of question. And of course, the main reason for it is that Russia is a nuclear power and nobody wants to risk an escalation of a conflict to the nuclear domain. NATO is a nuclear armed alliance. Certainly, nobody wants to risk that escalation on behalf of Ukraine. But the West can help, and the support has been very heartening. The support has been overwhelming. This international solidarity, of course, on the moral plane, is extremely important. In material and real terms, imposing really harsh sanctions on Russia, and I would venture to say much harsher than what President Biden has announced yesterday. We don't see President Putin on the list of sanctioned people. We don't see President Lukashenko, who's Putin's ally in Belarus, on the list of sanctioned people. So there is still some room to strengthen and to make these sanctions, these Western sanctions even more painful. There is also a financial part of the equation, I would say. Ukraine is suffering tremendously economically right now. You know, its sovereign debt is in trouble. Its currency is in trouble. So perhaps the least the West can do, if it's not going to put any boots on the ground, is to shore up Ukraine financially and to prevent it from a financial collapse amid this calamity. And in the future, when this conflict will be over, because it will be over, hopefully with fewer casualties rather than more, what the West can do is to think right now of something like a Marshall Plan to rebuild Ukraine and to put it back online quickly.
Terrell, what about the idea of more arms being shipped to Ukraine, even training, help with training Ukrainian forces as they are being called right now? Do you think that's something the West can do, or at this point, is it too late for that?
Well, the training component of it, yes, that's a bit too late. Depending on what platforms you send here, it will require a certain amount of training. Now, the reason why they're encouraging Javelins and Stingers, for example, the company of Stingers dealing with air, you know, anti-aircraft platform, and then you have a Javelin, which is a that pretty much deals with tanks, piercing tank armor. Those you can pretty much learn how to use it in about a week, right? And so those are ones where the Ukrainians have undergone so much training that they can pretty much teach themselves. So the only thing that the EU and the United States have to do right now is just to send those weapons, and then the Ukrainians will take care of it on their own. Now, if you're talking about a more sophisticated piece of hardware, that would have required much of preparation, more so now, because that would require troops on the ground here to help them learn how to use it, or they would have to go to Poland and some other EU country to do that. We're beyond that right now. But what would really make a world of difference is thousands of Javelins, thousands of Stingers to come here. They could really turn this war around, even if they were to do it now, send more javelins, more stingers, more munitions, that could definitely shift this war in a very meaningful way.
What about cyber attacks? We've heard that is one way Russia is attacking Ukraine. Terrell, have you seen that play out?
Yes, definitely. You know, one of the things that's really common, and this is not a new tactic, cyber attacks taking place on government websites, that's something that's been pretty common here. As it pertains to the common person, no. But those attacks on government websites are psychological warfare. I saw it in Georgia in 2008. In fact, the hacking in Georgia was so outlandish and obviously Russian. They literally had hacked into a government site. I can't remember the ministry exactly, but they created something of an image of former President Mikhail Saakashvili and him looking like Hitler. And so that was how sophisticated the hacking was against Georgia. And so I'm seeing that type of hacking, you know, that type of colorful hacking taking place here in Ukraine yet. But it's definitely something that's been taking place, because that's usually as part of the lead up to the bombing and shelling that we're seeing right now. In fact, I'm looking out the window. There is sirens going off. There's been sirens going off, throughout the day here. And the shelling usually begins at night, early in the morning, about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning. I could definitely hear from around that.
Wow. Please continue to be safe as you. We are appreciative of you joining us, but please continue to be safe. Mariana, on the issue of cybersecurity, it's not just Ukraine that is seeing the threat of this, and it could take many forms. This is something that Russia has done well. We know even here in the United States with misinformation, certainly the propaganda within Russia itself. Talk about how this long-term cyber warfare plays out.
Well, Kimberly, so there's two things. One is the cyber warfare, which is, you know, penetrating and prepositioning various malware and various cyber assets, as they say, in, you know, the systems of critical infrastructure, important websites of whatever adversaries Russia decides to attack. And Ukraine has been basically fighting this cyber war now for years. So this is nothing new. It just had intensified now in the lead up to the conventional war. But the other part of which you mentioned is the informational warfare. It is this propaganda. It's the release of fake news, as we learned to call them in this country. Just complete fabrications of facts. And I have to say that the primary victims of this information warfare are the Russians themselves. This propaganda machine has been brainwashing Russian population now for years. And it seems that that's at least part of the reason why Mr. Putin is able to get away with such outlandish and statements that any sane person would not believe. It's heartening to see that there are some protests in Russia right now in St. Petersburg, and I was checking in Novosibirsk, I think, and people are coming on the street and refusing to believe that Ukraine is run by Nazis and that, you know, there's a genocide being perpetrated against Ukrainian people. But I spent a couple of weeks in Moscow on a research trip doing archival research in 2017. And I have to say that the way just the government news channels, the way they operate, it is so sophisticated. It is not this kind of very sloganeering, primitive propaganda of the Soviet days. It's really well done. So much so that I myself started to doubt my sanity by the end of the 2 weeks and thinking, you know, what is the truth here? And what is, where are the lies? It's blended so skillfully together that it's really hard to tell apart. That is probably the single most powerful weapon that that Russia has employed on its own people.
So, Mariana, we are seeing this war play out in Europe. What is the end game here? And what is the threat to Europe? Can we expect this to expand beyond that? We only have about a minute left, but what do you think the end game is here?
Well, from the standpoint of Mr. Putin, the end game is probably to subdue Ukraine in some shape or form. It is not, I disagree that it is to recreate or reconstitute the Soviet Union. Putin has great contempt for the Bolsheviks and what they did to Russia. He's not a big fan of the Soviet Union per se. He is a fan and a supporter of this idea of Russian greatness. That for him comes, it seems, as a somehow not a merit-based thing, not a matter of creating the kind of, political, economic system, a way of governing the country that other people would want to emulate. It is really something that that he wants to impose. And I think he will not stop until, he gives it its best shot with Ukraine.
All right. Mariana Bucharin is a research fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Terrell Jermaine Starr is a journalist reporting from Kyiv. Thank you for joining us, and please be safe.
Thank you.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.